بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. The first weapon that Shaitan used on mankind was hasad, jealousy, and it happened with the children of Adam, where he instilled this emotion into the heart of Qabil. And Qabil, on the basis of this emotion of jealousy, expressed it by taking the life of his brother. And hence, jealousy, any time that it's felt within us, is a weapon that Shaitan uses. In the hadith we have, Al-hasad ya'kulul iman. Hasad, envy and jealousy, eats up your iman. Kama ta'kulun nar al-habab. Like fire eats up wood. If you are a mu'min, if you think that you are a believer, then hasad is a disease that will eat up your faith. Now, I don't want to leave you at that point, so I'll give you a remedy. I'll give you a remedy by which you can assure yourself that you will not have hasad, that you will not have jealousy. And that remedy is given by the Prophet. So the first hadith says that iman or faith is eaten up by jealousy. And then to counteract that, the Prophet gave a remedy, and he told that to Ali, and through Ali it came to us. And then we understand how to rid ourselves of that jealousy. He says, Ya Ali, Hubbuka al-Iman. Ali, your love is Iman. If a person loves you, it means his Iman grows, becomes stronger. So hasad, envy that eats up Iman, will not be able to harm that heart and that person who has your love in his heart. If a person has the love of Ahlul Bayt, then there is no way that envy or jealousy can affect him. Envy cannot affect you if you love Ahlul Bayt. So, to make you understand that a little bit more, send aloud salawats. We see many people will say, but we see a lot of Shias having envy. We see that in our friends, in our family, we see it in the masjid, we see everywhere, right? We see that Shias, you know, there are those who are envious and they have hasad. They have hasad. So, how is it that you are saying, or the Prophet is saying, or Islam is saying, that if you love Ali, then there's no way hasad can come in? And on the other side, we see there are Shias who have envy. So my friends, here's the thing. The hadith is not wrong, The saying of the Prophet is not wrong. It is the people who have envy, they must analyze their own self and put a question mark on their faith whether they actually have the love of Ali or not. They should first look at themselves and see, wait a minute, if I have envy, how can I have the love of Ahlul Bayt? And the principle behind that, the rule behind that, the standard behind that is very simple. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever seen a wealthy man being envious of a poor man? You know, like a wealthy man and he's saying, man, I wish that I could be poor like you. Have you ever seen a healthy man being envious of a sick man? Yeah. Have you ever seen a healthy man who says, oh, you know what, I want to have the disease you have. Please give me cancer. You have seen anyone like that? You haven't. Right? No healthy man is envious of a sick man. No wealthy man is envious of a poor man. It doesn't happen. You know, like you meet, for example, a beggar and you say, oh, how I wish in my heart I could be like you, a beggar. It doesn't happen. The reason it doesn't happen is because those who have something, when they come across those who don't, the emotion is not envy. You could have ego, that's another thing. You could have pride, that's another thing. But envy is only when you come across someone who is more gifted than you are, who has greater blessings than you are, more talent than you are. That's the only time envy can come about. So my friends, understand this. Those who have a treasure, there's no way that they could be envious of those who have nothing. And this is the reason and the basis on which someone who loves Ahlul Bayt can never be envious. Because if you have recognized that you have a treasure that others don't have, you will never be envious of whatever they are or what they have. Because you have something greater than them. Then if a person doesn't recognize the love of Ahlul Bayt as a treasure, then he can be envious. But if he loves Ahlul Bayt and he knows that they are a treasure, then there's no way that envy or hasad can enter your heart. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And here, this is the case, we see that the first assault of shaitan on mankind was hasad. Now I want to move forward. We have some ways to go and only have 3 nights to do it. If not, Friday and Saturday, we'll see if we can conclude. But I want to go on now. What is the second weapon of shaitan? Because this is historically speaking, he introduced these weapons one after another. You know, it's like, for example, you know, we introduce weapons in the world and say that, hey, look what we made. Then everyone starts buying it. Then they come out with another edition. You know, it's like the iPhone. iPhone 1 came out, everyone bought it. After 2 years, iPhone 2 came out. It's like, buy it again. You buy it again, right? So shaitan does the same thing. He comes out with his weapons, right? One after another. So when people, they buy something and get over it, then he introduces another one. And that comes about. So the second thing that shaitan did to mankind, and he sold to mankind, this idea that he sold. And here's where I want you to pay attention. Because it gets a little bit subtle here. Shaitan came to mankind and said to mankind that, listen, Allah created you intelligent. He gave you aql. He gave you intellect. He made you smart, right? Look at you, you are a smart guy, girl, right? He made you think that you are smart, you are intelligent. He gave you a brain. So why don't you use it? That's what Shaitan said. Allah gave you a brain, use it. He gave you a mind, use it. And we are like, really? Yeah, I am smart. Yeah, Allah didn't make me a stone, or a rock, or an animal, or a robot. I have a brain. I can use my brain. Shaitan says, yes, use it. And you're like, yes, of course, I'll use it. You know, whenever Allah tells you something, you use your mind. Use your brain and see if it makes sense. If it makes sense, do it. If it doesn't make sense, don't do it. And we're like, oh, you know, he is right. He is right. I mean, I am intelligent, right? I am smart. I have a brain. So Allah, you know, I'm not going to listen to everything you say. I'll only listen to that which makes sense to me. I will use my own brain to decide what's good for me. This is what Shaitan, second thing, the second weapon Shaitan came about and used it very smartly. And you see this, and we took it, we were sold. People were sold, and you're like, yes, that is so good. I will use my mind whenever Allah orders me to do something, whenever Allah commands me to do something, I will first make sure it's good for me, then I will do it. If I can't think, if I don't think it's right, I won't do it. This is the second weapon of Shaitan. Where did he introduce it? In the time of Prophet Nuh. Yes. In the time of Prophet Nuh is when he introduced this weapon. He used it and it worked. Let me explain the whole incident to you so you understand where this was done, if you send us out of lots. Now, most of you know Prophet Nuh and his story. You know that he lived a very long life. And if you don't know, as a matter of fact, he lived 9 generations after Adam. He was born 9 generations after Adam. So the people who were the children of Adam did not go far away. They were all in one region. In fact, they lived in a valley. They lived in a valley. And so what happened, they didn't live in a valley, they were on a mountain first, but then they went off the mountain, slowly and slowly, and in 9 generations, everyone was living in the valley instead of the mountain. The only rule at that time for the children of Adam was that you should not leave the mountain and go to the valley. As history, I'm explaining this if you don't know. So what happened is that Shaitan wanted to attract the people away from the mountain and bring them to the valley. You know how he did it? Of course. So let me tell you how he did it. Right. He used, you know, something that is exciting and fun. Shaitan, in order to bring the people off the mountain, he started playing music. He started playing music. People who were on the mountain were listening to the music coming from the valley, and they were like, wow, that sounds like fun. And slowly, one by one, they started to go there, you know, where the party was. And after 9 generations, everyone was in the valley, in the party. Everyone was in the party except for Prophet Nuh. Now, when Prophet Nuh was left alone, that's when Allah told him, go and call your people. Go and call the people towards Allah. Now when Prophet Nuh went down to the valley to invite the people back to Allah, back to righteousness, back to the truth, so obviously he had a tough time. And he preached with them for 500 years. 500 years, that's not a short time. You know, 500 years is a long period, right? Generations went by and he's preaching to them and no one accepted. Now, we, for example, I mean, just for you to see the difference, between the character of prophets and who Allah made prophets and others. Really, there's a huge difference. If you want to see, 500 years Prophet Nuh preached to the people, bringing them, asking them to come back. And they used to treat him badly. They not only called him names, they ridiculed him. And when that didn't work, they beat him up. They abused him. They hurt him, persecuted him to such an extent that he would come back injured. He would be knocked out unconscious. And the angels would come and remedy him and cure him and help him to get up. As soon as he get back up again, he would go back to the people. And the same people will beat him up again. And then again he would come back. And at the end, Prophet Nuh, in his supplication to Allah, asks Allah, and he tells Allah that, "Allah, I even told them that still after all that you have done to me, do istighfar and ask for forgiveness, Allah will forgive you. Allah will forgive you, ask for forgiveness." Now my friends, understand this, right? I'm going to give an example so you can compare the two and then appreciate what Prophet Nuh and the likes of him, the Anbiya, their characters are about. I'll give this comparison so you understand this. Really, look at it. This Prophet Nuh, preaching to the people 500 years, is being beaten up by them. And still he's going back to them and he's telling them, do istighfar, Allah will forgive you. Really. On one hand, you see this character, to appreciate it, compare it, for example, you know, with an incident I will give an example of. This one alim, he goes in, you know, giving speeches somewhere. And so what happened is that when comes down, someone starts arguing with him. Someone starts to argue with him. It's Maulana. Someone starts arguing with him, the argument escalates. The argument escalates, and then what happened is that the other person gets angry and he slaps the Maulana. Ooh, yeah, that's right. Imagine that, he slaps the Maulana and walks out. And the Maulana, now obviously he's angry. You know, he's just being slapped, you know, with a silly slap on his face. And now his face is red. Now he goes back, the person goes back, other people meet him and say, "You shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have done that." He says, "All right, you know what? You're right. I got angry. I lost my mind. You know, I'm already hot-tempered." So he went back to the Maulana to ask for forgiveness. He goes to him and says, "Maulana, you know, listen, yeah." Maulana's like, "What do you want now, you know?" He says, "Well, you know, I'm sorry about what you did. No, no, I don't want to hear any of this." He said, "But I'm asking for forgiveness." He says, "No, now you and me will meet on the Day of Judgment. And I will hold your neck on the Day of Judgment, and Hazrat Fatima will be there, and Rasulullah will be there, and Imam Ali will be there, and there I'll take care of you." And they still want to guide you and to help you and to make you better. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. Now, if you work with the people for 500 years and they don't listen, you can make a conclusion, you know, they're not going to change. Right? After 500 years, I mean, we try for 5 days, and if it doesn't work, say, "Let's go move on, you know, go somewhere else and try somewhere else." 500 years, I think, is long enough time to say that you can call it quits. Say that, "Allah, this is it, these people won't change." So that's what Nuh did. After 500 years, he said, "Allah, I tried every means possible. I worked with them day and night. I offered them everything, but still they don't listen. Allah, now you send an azab and get rid of them. Get rid of them. Empty the earth of these people." So the dua came from a prophet, and Allah listens to his prophet. He accepted the dua. He says, "All right, I accept the dua. Yeah, I accept the dua. I will destroy these people and finish them off. But before that happens, Nuh, I want you to do one thing." What's that? "Before my azab comes, you make a ship. Make an ark." Now, obviously knows like Allah, you command me, fine, alhamdulillah, I'll do it. I have done everything you told me to do, so I'll do this also. Now this was a little bit difficult task. You see, we read these stories, but we really don't pay attention to the circumstances so we can really understand the gravity of the hukum and the command and the obedience of the Prophet. Understand this. Allah asked him to make an ark. He asked him to make a ship, right? He was living in a valley. The people are living in a valley. There is no water there. There is no lake there. It's not oceanfront, nothing. They're living in a valley, and Nuh knows what the people are going to say. He knows exactly the reaction of the people when he will start doing this. And Nuh then, you know, starts to build the boat. He's doing what Allah asked him to do. And as soon as he starts building the ship, the word gets around. The word gets around that, hey, did you hear, guys? The old man Noah, he's building a ship. And everyone's like, what? He's building a ship? For what? You know? And then everyone, like a spectacle, would come over there and see. Is he really doing this? Yes, he is. And they'll start laughing. And they'll say, you see, we told you he was crazy. He told you he was crazy. Why would you build a ship in the middle of a valley where there is no water, where there's no access to water? You see, everyone was laughing and ridiculing at Nuh. Nuh was following what Allah said. Allah, you told me to do this. I'm doing this. Now was the test of Nuh. You see, when Allah gives a command and wants you to do something, sometimes it looks crazy. People, when they look at it, they will think that you are crazy, you're insane, you have no brain. They will look at it and say that. But still, if Allah commanded us to do this, then we will do it, no matter what happens. And that's, if you understand that, this that I said, let me now make a conclusion from this so that truly you can look at yourself and appreciate the ideology that has been given to you. When the hadith came from the Prophet who said that the Ahlul Bayt are like the ship of Nuh. The Ahlul Bayt are like the ship of Nuh. Whoever gets on it will be saved, and whoever gets off it will be drowned and destroyed. That's the hadith, right? You all read it, and you all know it. So that hadith, if you understand it from the context that I just explained to you, then you would know. This ship that started with the Prophet, continued with Imam Ali, now has come to Imam Zamana. He is the last leg of that ship, the last piece of that ship. That ship is being built and has been given to us. Now we, who have been told that you get on the ship, and you get on the ship and believe in it, believe in this ideology. Now we tell the world that we believe in the Imams. We believe in Imam Mahdi. We believe that Imam Mahdi is ghaib, he's hidden, and he's been living here for 1200 years, and he is going to come back to us. Those who are onlookers, just like they laughed at Nuh, are laughing at you. They say, what, you believe in an unseen guy who's living some mountain or somewhere like that? That's what you believe in? What are you going to say to them? Well, yes, we do. They say, all right, man, that's it. Right? They will laugh at you, just like they were laughing at Nuh, because Nuh was commanded to do this, he did it. And he did it in spite of knowing that people will ridicule him, people will say wrong to him. And just like that, you have been told to stay firm with the Imam and to build that ship that the Imam is going to ride when he comes back. Now that you're doing it, people are laughing at you, people are looking at you, and they are ridiculing you. But just understand it from the example of Nuh, that just like the Allah, when Allah gives a command, he knows the wisdom, and he knows that you will be the one who will have the last laugh, not them. This is the reality, my friends, to understand. Don't be ashamed of the fact that we are believing in an Imam who's ghaib, who's not there. No. You don't understand that this is the hukum and the command of Allah. And I'll explain that more, inshallah, tomorrow and the after tomorrow. Send us salawats.
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد.
So now Nuh is building this ship in the middle of nowhere. And everyone looks at it and laughs at it. And he keeps on doing it. And he builds it. Now the ship has been built. The ship has been built. And then it is time for Allah to send his azab. The azab came in the form of a storm. The storm rose up, came out, hit them, started raining hard. Everyone knew that this is not usual. This is not normal. It's raining really hard and it is continuously raining. It starts to flood. People start getting afraid. People start getting afraid. And, you know, they're running here and there. Nuh has told his people that when the storm comes, get on the ship. He says, get on the ship. And he says, all right. Everyone, you know, those people who are with him, they knew that. Get on the ship, you will be saved. So now what happens is that the son of Nuh, you know, the son of Nuh, my friends, he says, I won't get on the ship. He says, I won't get on the ship. And I want you to see the exchange of words between the father and son. Read. Exchange a word between the father and son. What does the father say and what does the son say? My friends, this is where we learn ideology. This is where we learn ideology. The father tells the son, La asim al yawm min amrillah. He says, nothing is going to save you from the command of Allah today. Today, there's nothing that can save you from the command of Allah. This is what Nuh tells his son. And the son replies to him and says, Sa'awi ila jabalin ya'asimuni. He says, I will go to the mountain will save me. My friends, I will go to the mountain will save me. From what? From the storm. I will run away from the storm, I will go to the mountain will save me. Nuh is saying, you see, Nuh didn't say that Allah will not save anyone. Allah will not save anyone from the storm. He didn't say that. He said, no one can save you from the command of Allah. The storm is not the command of Allah. You see, this is where we don't understand the wisdom of Allah. What does He mean to do? That's why, my friends, instead of trusting what Allah says and doing it, knowing that He has more wisdom than we do, and He has more knowledge than we do, what happens is that this son is looking at the ship, he's looking at the mountain, and he's looking at the storm. He sees the storm is big, the mountain is big, and the ship is small. He says, if I want to be saved, let me do some math here. Let me do some math here. Storm is big, the mountain is big, the ship is small. So scratch out the ship, go to the mountain. You see, he's working his mind. He's working his own brain. He's working his own reasoning, trying to think that the mountain can save him from the command of Allah. Nuh said, no, nothing will save you from the command of Allah. So what did he do? He, instead of listening to what Allah said, and getting on the ship, he went to the mountain to seek refuge. What happened at the end? What happened at the end? That kid was destroyed, and the people on the ship were saved. In other words, anyone, when the command of Allah comes, Allah knows that this command, how far it's going, how far it's reaching, in His wisdom, He has given you this command. When you use your mind, when you use your aql to oppose the command of Allah, then there's only thing that will happen to you is destruction. Shaitan knows this. Shaitan knows this, and that's why he gave this weapon to you and said, I will use this weapon on you. Go ahead, use your mind. Allah made you intelligent, right? Whenever Allah commands you, now you think for yourself. Now you use that mind to make sure that you don't do what he says. Try to understand. And most of the times we don't understand. And anyone who tries to make you understand will fail. Why? Because there are certain things that we can't understand that only Allah knows. only Allah knows, and you don't know. For example, you know, why did Allah make pork haram? You know, Allah says pork is haram. So, why? There is a reason. Do I know the reason? Now everyone starts to make up. Well, you know, scientists say, you know, that, you know, this causes this worms to go in your stomach and this and that, this and that. And this is a mistake that people make. Why are you even trying to justify that? Don't say that. Because when you say it, what will happen is they'll bring 10 other scientists who will say something else. Because knowing doctors and scientists, they have a spectrum of views from yes to no. And you can find every view you can find from anywhere. You bring me 10 doctors who say this is bad, I'll bring you 10 doctors who say this is good. That's the way it works. It's based on their opinion. And now when we start using that, then, you know, we lose the actual reasoning behind it. Just like Nuh was told that, listen, no one is going to save you today except for this ship. And you're saying, well, no, I will seek refuge in the mountain. Yes, the mountain is bigger. Let me go there. It looks better. It makes more sense to me. The minute you start thinking like that is the minute that you are going to get yourself into trouble. This is, my friend's reality. This is where akal that comes in and uses. Yes, Nuh's son was destroyed. And Nuh had other children who were good. But it so happened that his one bad son was the one Allah introduced to us. Sometimes what happens when you look at the story of Prophet Nuh, you feel bad for him. You feel bad for Prophet Nuh. Right? The reason is that, listen, he had some good other children who were mu'min and muttaqi and they followed him. But we don't know them. The only son Allah introduced was the bad apple. The bad one. And then because he introduced the bad one, now every time Nuh's name is going to be taken by anyone in the future, everyone will say, oh yeah, he's the prophet with the bad son, right? That's what happens, right? Every time you speak of Nuh, yes, he's the one who had the bad son. Remember, Nuh's son, he was bad. And really, sometimes you feel bad. And then, as an example, I'll give you. Send a salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
You know, we all have families, and our families have good people and bad people. You know, we have those people in our families that, you know, we say, Alhamdulillah, my uncle, you know, one uncle of yours, let's say he is, you know, someone, a doctor, you know, let's say. Or, you know, he works, you know, he's the president of Kui Center. So you're like, you know, he's the president of Kui Center. It's a good thing, all right? Right? So what happened to the president of Kui Center, respectable? You have another uncle in jail. You know, he's a criminal, you know, a fraud, you know. He's in jail for fraud. So, now, when I want to introduce you, there's two ways to do it. I'm doing it, right? For example, I can say, oh, you know what? This, you know, meet him. His uncle is the, you know, president of Kui Center. So you'll be like, oh, mashallah, how are you doing, brother? Right? You see, the reaction of people is good. Now, if I introduce you with your other uncle and say, oh, meet him. He's the uncle. You know, his uncle is in jail. Even the fraud guy who did the fraud the other year, yeah, he's in jail. And that's his nephew. And you're like, hello. You know? Get away from me, I don't want to know you. Right? This is what happens, right? My friend, understand that. This is really important to understand. Allah, Nuh had many children. All of them were good except for one. Why did you introduce Nuh in this way? Why did you introduce Nuh with that bad son so that now every time we think of Nuh, we are thinking he's the one with the bad child. Have you ever paid attention to that? Why did Allah do that? From here we'll understand something, my friends. Allah wanted the spotlight on that son. Allah wanted the spotlight on that son that he is bad. But Allah is saying, don't look at the son who's bad. Look at the father who's good. Look at the father who, until the last minute, until the last minute, he is trying to guide his son and cares for his son. He gives the example of Noah to let everyone know that you might have a good son or a bad son, but it doesn't mean you lose hope on them or you let them go. Until you are alive, you try to guide them. If you guide them, you are not at fault. Then it's Allah's job to take care of them. This is, my friends, the reality. You want to know how to raise children? If you see your son going bad, oh, he takes drugs, he's doing this, he's doing that. You as a father, you as a mother, you as a parent should not lose hope in your child. Try to save him until you can. And then after that, it's Allah's job. You try, you do your job, and that's what Allah wanted to point out in the story of Noah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, the final question remains, and it's this. You can ask me, and it's true, you will say that, okay, Mawlana, you know, we understand what you're saying, you know, that, okay, when Allah gives a command, you don't use your akal, this and that. But if that's the case, if Allah just wanted us to follow commands, if Allah just wanted us to do what He says, then why did Allah truly give us a brain? Why did Allah give us a brain in the first place? He could have just made us a robot, right? Program us and say, sajda, and you go into sajda. Get up, you know, walk, and we're walking, you know. He could have done that. Why did He give us a mind? Why did He give us a brain? Why did He give us intelligence then? Is that a valid question? Don't be afraid. It is a valid question. If Allah just wanted us to follow His commands, why did Allah give us a brain in the first? This is what Shaitan is saying. Right? This is exactly what Shaitan says. So I don't want you to be duped by him. Know the answer before you leave this room. So that he doesn't come to you and say, you see how these Mawlanas, you know, they just want you to be dumb, that's all. That's all they want, right? This is exactly what he'll tell you. This is exactly the insinuation that's going to come to your mind. And you know what? Here's the issue, my friend. And understand it very well. Islam doesn't say don't use your aql. Islam never said, no, there's no use for the aql, we are just giving to you to show off, you know? Here you go. The only reason we gave you aql is so that you can play Sudoku in the plane, you know? You're like, okay. You know, that's the only reason he gave you an aql for, a brain for? No, there is a reason and there's a place to use your aql, use your intelligence. Ever understand this? There is a major reason Allah gave you an aql. And so that you can use this aql, not that you don't use it, but rather use it. But how do you use it? Where do you use it? That's the question. Where do you use it? That's the question. You see, before we even get to the command of Allah, or the rules of Allah, or the rules of Islam, or the wajibat, or the obligation, all of these things come under the umbrella of furu'ud-deen. They all come under the umbrella of furu'ud-deen. All the wajibat, right? Prayer is wajib, psalm, zakat, whatever is wajib, all comes under there. But even before you come to that, there is a whole different field you must cross. It is called usul-ud-deen. It is called usul-ud-deen. Allah says, listen, I don't want you to listen to me. I don't want you to follow me if you don't know me. If you haven't accepted me. That's why he says, La ikraha fi deen. There is no compulsion in religion. I will not compel anyone to do anything I say unless they submit to me. How do I submit to you? He says, you use your brain here. Use your brain. You use your mind to find me. You use your mind to know me. To understand that I am God, that I am your creator, that I am your master. Use your brain to understand that. I will not force you to understand it. I will not compel you to understand that. You think of it, you use your mind, you look around. That's why nowhere in the Quran Allah gives a command to believe in Him. There's nowhere in the Quran that Allah says, believe in me, otherwise I'll make you disfigured, you know? Believe in me or I'll throw acid in your face. He doesn't say that. There's no place he says that. Any place where you see the issue of belief comes, Allah says, just look around and see. Don't you realize this is the way? Don't you see this is the way? Don't you understand this is the way? He's appealing to your mind and your brain so that you can think. And by thinking, by reasoning, by using your intelligence, then come to know that I am God. Come to know that I am God. But one, here's the thing. Once you have accepted me as God, once you have accepted me as the creator, once you have accepted me as the all-powerful and the all-knowing, and you know that I am Allah, I am the one who made you, now don't come when I give you a command now, after you know who I am, when I give you a command now, now don't come to me and say, Allah, no, let me think about it. Well, what you're saying is right or wrong. You see, when you say this to Allah, as a Muslim, someone who has accepted Allah, if you say, Allah, wait, if you give me a command, I will find out if it's right or wrong for me, then Allah is saying that what you're actually telling me is that I am brainless. Really? You're doubting my command after knowing me? In other words, anyone who doubts the commands of Allah, anyone who doubts that the commands of Allah are true, are in fact saying that Allah does not know better. This is what they are saying. My friends, our job first, if you have doubts in the commands of Allah, then don't see if the commands are right or wrong. Go and look into yourself if you actually believe in Allah as God or not. That's what you need to do. You go there and believe. See, this is what happens. If you believe, for example, Imam Ali is your Imam. Let's say you believe that. You say that, oh, who's your Imam? Imam Ali. Okay, good. Now Imam Ali says, do this. And you're like, really? Let me see, Mawla. You're a good man and everything, but I need to see if it's good for me. Let me ask my lawyer. If you don't accept Ali, if you haven't accepted Ali as your Imam, then you know what? There's no compulsion on you. No one is hitting your head or beating you up to accept him. We will give you all the reasoning so you can understand it, but we won't beat you up. But once you have accepted him, now don't come and say that, oh, you know what? We will not accept it. As an example, I'll give you so you understand it at your level. Send us otherwise. One lazy kid, he's from a Shia family, in his high school, you know, in high school, the army comes there to enroll you, you know, this and that, you know. Not only was he lazy, he was also, you know, stupid enough to enroll, right? His mom and dad didn't know at all. His friends told him, hey, you know what? Man, you know, why don't you enroll? Why don't you enroll, man? Why don't you enroll? He's like, yeah, yeah, I can enroll. I dare you. I double dare you. So then signs up. So now he signed up. What happened is that, you know, a few weeks later, you know, the army guys come to their home and say, hey, he enrolled in the army. You better come. Let's go. And the mom and dad found out, what's going on here? You know, well, anyway, they take him, right? They take him for training. So he went for training. Now, when he went for training, you know, obviously, you know, I mean, he enrolled in the army, he enrolled himself. No one forced him, no one compelled him. He enlisted in the army and he went there. Okay, he went there, good. So then what happened is that now he goes there and he thinks that, hey, it's like his home, you know. He goes to the army and 4 o'clock in the morning, the alarm goes off and everyone's, you know, there. Commander walks in the room, the sergeant walks in the room and starts waking them everyone up. He's like, you know, get away. And the commander says, what? You better get up, boy. He's like, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. This is an ungodly hour to wake up. What are you talking about? 4 o'clock, I wake up. He says, what? All right, boy, that's it. You get up and you give me 10 right now. You know, push-ups. That's how they deal with you. And he's like, what is this? I sleep till 8. He says, not here. Here you sleep till 4. That's it. So he gets up and he's angry and this and that. He goes for breakfast, and in the line of breakfast, you know, they put some mush in his plate. Like, what's this? You know, like oatmeal or something put together, you know? They put this mush in the plate, and he's like looking at it, he's like, where are the eggs? Where are the omelet? He said, what are you talking about, eggs and omelet? You don't get eggs and omelet here. That's all you get. You better eat it. You better lap it up. Now this guy is like, but listen, I didn't sign up for this. You know? I didn't sign up for this. They said, listen, before you signed up, you were free to sign up. Whether you want to join or not, it doesn't matter. Really, we don't force you to join. But once you have joined and enlisted, now you have to follow our rules. Whatever we say, you have to do. Understand this. This is how everything works. Before you join any club, before you join anything, you have the choice and the option and the free will to join that. But once you join, then you have to follow the rules of whatever organization you join. Islam is the same way. Before you join Islam, Islam doesn't compel you to join. It doesn't force you to join. It doesn't tell you that you better join. Nothing. But once you join, you cannot complain now that I have to pray 5 times, I have to keep fasting, or go for hajj, or give zakat and khums. All of this is a part and parcel of what you're joining into. And this, my friends, is the reality. Before you accept Islam, take your time. No one is forcing you. But after you accepted Him, then when the command of Allah comes, don't be doubting the command of Allah. This is insulting. This is insulting. If Allah says, wear hijab, and you're saying, well, let me see if it's right or wrong for me, and I'll do that. Sorry. You know? That's the rules. You better follow the rules. Otherwise, go back and see if you have accepted Allah or not in the first place. Right? If you have to pray, oh, we don't need to pray this and no. You have to pray. And if you have a doubt in that, go back and check whether you actually believe in Allah or not. Then come back to this. This, my friends, is the reality. Akal, shaitan thought to use it in the commands of Allah. We don't use it opposing the commands of Allah. We use our akal to find Allah, to search for Him, to believe in Him, to accept Him, to have conviction and iman in Him. Salawat ala Muhammad. Yes, ma'am. Here, inshallah, I will stop for today. If you want to truly give our condolences today. I don't want to stop over here. Just say that the people who came to Karbala, really, the people who came to Karbala are people who understood the Imam and they believed in him. And that's why after they came to Karbala, you see, no one protested, no one doubted anything that Imam Hussein had said. Yes, my friends. I'll mention one thing to you so that you get ready, right? One thing I'll mention to you. People go for ziyarat of Imam Hussein, and inshallah, may Allah take you all to the ziyarat of Imam Hussein in Karbala. And may inshallah we be amongst those that Imam Hussein will regard as his own. But I want you to say this. Not everyone who goes to Karbala is the same. Really, not only those who go to Karbala are the same. Many people came to Karbala. Some came for Imam Hussein. Some came for Yazid. In fact, most of them came for Yazid. Some came for Imam Hussein, only some. Most of them came for Yazid. So not everyone who came to Karbala was good, right? My friends, even today when a person goes to Karbala, the idea is, you see, Most people don't go to visit the Imam. They don't go to make ziyarat of the Imam. They go to make ziyarat of the Haram. Yes. I want you to really pay attention to what this means. Who's going to meet the Imam? Who goes to meet the Imam? Someone who goes to meet the Imam, he's not interested in the Haram or the Dhari. He's interested in the Imam. Hajj, when we look at Hajj, there's a hadith that says anyone who goes to Hajj, the completion of Hajj is the meeting of the Imam. Is the meeting of the Imam. That is the completion of Hajj. When we look at it, when do you meet the Imam? A person meets the Imam. You can open the light for 5 minutes. Let me explain this point. A person meets the Imam when he meets the vision of the Imam. You see, when you meet the Imam, a lot of people want to see the Imam, and they think that by seeing the Imam physically, it's meeting the Imam. No, it's not. Seeing the Imam is different than meeting the Imam. Seeing the Imam, if everyone sees the Imam right now, it doesn't make them good. Really, it doesn't make them more. The people who saw the Imams most, the people who saw the Prophet most, were hypocrites. Hypocrites who were with them all the time. They're the one who saw the Imam. Our goal is not to see the Imam, it is to meet the Imam. Meet the Imam means to see him eye to eye. To see what he is seeing, to have the vision that he has. That's the meaning of meeting the Imam. You want to meet the Imam? You meet the Imam by knowing his vision. My friends, the people in Karbala, they saw the vision of Imam Hussein and they met his vision. They saw the vision and they met his vision. But even amongst them, there are differences. Even amongst the people of Karbala, at that height, there are differences. Some are different than others. Some met the vision of the Imam more than others. More than others, they met the vision of the Imam. Subhanallah, how can I explain this? How can I explain this, my friends? You see, truly, everyone saw the vision, but there are some who are greater than others. My friends, the one who saw the vision of the Imam the furthest, the most, at the highest level, that no one else in Karbala was able to see, was given the standard of Islam. Was given the standard of Imam Hussein, the flag of Imam Hussein. Why did Abbas become the flag bearer? Not because he's strong, or he has more muscles, or he can use a sword. You think that's the reason Imam Hussein would make someone a flag bearer? That is a complete lack of misunderstanding on our part. The reason Abbas became the flag bearer is because he saw what Imam Hussein was seeing more than anyone else. He understood what the Imam stands for more than anyone else. This is what it means to come close to the Imam. When I want to go closer to the Imam, am I able to see what the Imam is seeing? To what extent? The further I make my vision grow, the further I will be closer to the Imam. Abbas was the closest. That's why he was the dearest to Imam Hussein. And because he knew that what Abbas was seeing, no one else was able to see. You see, this is the reason Abbas, his vision was not just in that time, just like Imam Hussein, his vision transcends centuries and millennium. and ages and eras, he was seeing so far off. You see, Abbas was also seeing that far. Hazrat Abbas was seeing that far. And just like Hussein was concerned in his heart, in his vision was the picture of you. You who are sitting here right now in the 21st century, he was thinking of you. You were in his vision. Abbas was also thinking of you sitting here. Everything he was doing was to tell something and give that, be that role model for us. That's how far Abbas was saying. And this is the reason why he's called Babul Hawaij. This is the reason why he's called Babul Hawaij. You know why? Because Abbas was looking for what you needed right now. His vision was extending to your needs. He was keeping you in mind because his intention and his vision reached that far. So Allah said that you will be Babul Hawaij, the door where the needs of people are met because you were concerned about their needs. Your heart was concerned about them. This is the reason why. Babul Hawaij. Abbas was something else. Really, he was something else. When you look at Abbas, just a few things I want to say about Abbas right now. Then we'll go to the Masail. So that you understand who is Abbas. You know, there's a reason why Allah kept all of the shuhada of Karbala together next to Imam Hussein, but Abbas is separate. Abbas is separate. You want to go to Abbas, you have to go somewhere else. In fact, it said, go to Abbas and seek permission to meet Imam Hussein. That is Abbas. Now, when you look at Abbas, you see, a person really, sometimes by reading history, really, it doesn't do justice to these personalities. That's why we look at Sirat. You see, if you read the history of Karbala, it would be just some events happening. But if you really want to know the intensity of these events, if you want to know the gravity of what happened, look at the Sirat of the Prophet. Look at the Sirat of Imam Ali. From there, you begin to understand. From there you begin to understand. You know, let me just tell you the seerah of the Prophet. One seerah, so you understand what I mean when I say this. You know, Abdullah ibn Abbas says that this was a seerah of the Prophet that every time, no matter where the Prophet is, whether he's in the masjid or in his house or in the battlefield, anywhere, no matter where he is, every time the Prophet would lay his eyes on Hussein, he would start to cry. He would start to cry. He would just, you know, tears would come out of his eyes. Really. And we read that. This is the seerah, right? My friends from here understand. He cried for Imam Ali once before the month of Ramadan. In Shaban, he was explaining about the month of Ramadan, and in the middle, Imam Ali stood up to ask a question, and he says to the Prophet, what is the best action or deed that we can do in Ramadan? Imam Ali just stood up and asked him. As soon as the Prophet saw Imam Ali, he started to cry. He started to cry. And Ali looked at him and said, Rasulullah, what are you crying for? What are you crying for? He said, Ali, the image of what will happen to you in Ramadan came in front of my eyes. Just the image of what will happen to you came into my eyes, that the blood from your head will flow from your beard. And I could not myself. I started crying. My friends, understand this. Understand this, really. Once he cried for Imam Ali, and you know what happened to Imam Ali. You know what happened to Imam Ali? He cried once looking at Imam Ali. When he used to see Fatima, really, his reaction was not crying. It was that he would be comforted by the face of Fatima. When something happened in the Prophet, this ayat came down about Jahannam, and the Prophet was crying so much. He was sobbing so much that everyone, all the companions were trying to comfort him. He would not stop crying. Salman, he was sitting there, and they asked him, Salman, you know him more than us. You do something. So Salman says, all right, I know how to make him stop crying. I know how to make him stop crying. How? You know what he did? Salman went to the house of Fatima, knocked on the door and said, Fatima, we need you. We need you. Rasulullah is uncontrollably crying. We want you to come here before something happens to him. When Fatima came out, you see Rasulullah stopped crying, looking at her. She was the peace of his heart. But then, my friends, from here when I read this, and now I read the fact that every time he looks at Imam Hussein, he just lays eyes on Imam Hussein, he starts crying. You see, history can never justify what happened with Imam Hussein. When we look at Rasulullah, what is Rasulullah looking at? That every time he sees Hussein, he cannot stop crying. That which Rasulullah is looking at, can you imagine that? From here we get to know what happened with Hussein. The gravity of what happened with Hussein, Rasulullah. What happened with Hussein that we don't know that you are crying so much? Really, my friends, from here we get to know. And just like that, you know, when we look at the seerah of Imam Ali, from there we understand. He had all children and he loved everyone, but Abbas was special for him. Abbas was special for Imam Ali. Every time Abbas will come in the room, Ali's face will light up. Ali's face will light up. He was already Noor. He was already enlightened. But when Abbas would come, you would see a different Ali. He would be like that around Abbas. Abbas was special for Ali. Really, Abbas was special for Ali. This Abbas, my friends, you want to know this. Really. When we speak of Abbas, there's something in a Shia that uncontrollably he cries in a very bad way. Like a child, he will sob. What is it? What is it that made you so close to Abbas? How well do you know Abbas, my friends? Tell me, how well do you know Abbas? Have you read his biography? Have you read any books about him? No, we didn't read books about him. Do you know his life? No, we don't know his life. Do you know what happened to him or how he lived before Karbala? No, we don't know. Did he come in your dream and embrace you? No. Then why is it that you love Abbas so much? Why is it that you love Abbas so much? You just heard a few masaib of Abbas from Karbala, from Ashura. Just a few things that you heard about Abbas and he, and that little knowledge that you have is making you cry for him, making your heart bleed for him. Can you imagine who Abbas is? That his little knowledge of Abbas has this effect on you? Can you imagine how that Abbas that you don't know anything about, just a few things that he did in Karbala, and you are going crazy over him. He has affected you in such a way. My friends, all I say is this much. If Abbas is that great, that a few stories that you know about Abbas have made you crazy about Abbas and makes you cry for Abbas and your heart bleed for Abbas, then what effect did Abbas has on Hussein and Zainab? What effect has Abbas on Hussein and Zainab? Imagine the effect he has left on Hussein. Imagine the effect he has left on Zainab. Imagine what they went through knowing Abbas in the way they did when Abbas left them. This is Abbas, my friends. This is Abbas. You know Abbas? Abbas says, this is what he said. He said that, you know, I loved Hussein so much. I loved Hussein so much that I always wanted to kiss his face. I always wanted to kiss his face. But I was too ashamed. I was too shy to do that. So instead of kissing the face of Hussein, you know what I would do? I would go to the children of Hussein and kiss their feet. I would kiss their feet. This, my friend, is Abbas. This is Abbas. Subhanallah. Now let us go to Karbala. Abbas, that support of Hussein. Abbas, that person who knew the vision of Hussein. Now that Abbas, as we come to Abbas. When we look at Abbas on the day of Ashura, it is very difficult for Abbas because every child that was Hussein's child that belonged to Bani Hashim, it is Abbas who trained him. They were his students. They were his students. Abbas trained these children. He looked after them. He trained them. And as they went to the battlefield and died, they all looked to Abbas to show off to their teacher. Look what we are doing. Look, are you proud of us? Our teacher Abbas would look at them with such pride in his eyes that, my children, you have made your uncle so proud. You have made your uncle so proud. Now, Abbas, who has lived to show and to light, everyone knew that what kind of a fighter was Abbas, and everyone just wanted to see Abbas fight. But this was Abbas's test, that the mastery that he had and the expertise that he had, he was never able to do what he is able to do. Abbas was kept away, and now the test of Abbas was, Abbas, you will fight, but not with a sword, Abbas. You will fight with your patience, Abbas. You will fight with your patience, Abbas. And Abbas, till the end, was living there. He was staying there. He was staying there and living there and seeing what was going on. And at the end, he came to Hussein. He came to Hussein in the last moments. He came to Hussein and said, Mawla, my master, I ask you, allow me to go to the battlefield. Allow me to go to the battlefield. Imam Hussein looked at Abbas and said, Abbas, if you leave, then who will be the flag bearer of this army? All Abbas could say and ask was, Mawla, which army are you talking of? Which army are you talking of? Everyone is dead. Now it's just you and me. And I will not let you go before me. So allow me to go. So Hussein said, go and see the people of the camp, because they, as long as you are alive, they have hope. As long as you are alive, they have the strength to move on, Abbas. Go and see them before you leave here. Abbas went, and it is said that when Abbas looked into the tent of the children, he saw these little children dying of thirst and hunger, eyes coming out of their sockets, looking at Abbas, and everyone had fear that if Abbas goes, what will happen to us? If Abbas goes away, what will happen to us? And the children, all of them saying, Alatash, Alatash, we are dying of thirst, we are dying of thirst. So now Abbas looks at them, and then the leader of the children, it was Sakina, the daughter of Imam Hussein, who comes forward to Abbas. Abbas had a special liking to her. He loved her very much. And then Sakina says, Ammu Abbas, can we have some water? This thirst is killing us. This thirst is killing us. Abbas just looked at the plight of the children. And then Abbas now goes and says, all right, I will bring water. Now Abbas finds his meaning. Now Abbas finds his goal and destination. He knows that this is his mission, to bring water to the camp of Hussein, so that at least I can do this before I go. Let me bring some water so that you all can quench your thirst. Abbas now takes his saber, and now he takes the flag, he takes the water bag, gets on the horse, and as he charges the river with such ferocity, he charges the river that the army that was stationed there, they start moving away. No one wants to fight Abbas. Anyone who would come close to him, Abbas would wipe them out. He would go right through the army, and right through the ranks he went. And as he went through the ranks, he came to the river. He came up to the river, and something came over him. He looked at this river, and then he stopped there and addressed the river and said a couplet which says, oh river, do not try to tempt me, because Hussein and his children are thirsty. I will not be tempted by you until Hussein finds me. I would rather die than to give my Islam and give my submission to you. I will take you to Hussein before I come to you. So now with that, Abbas put the water back inside. He put the water back inside the river as it filled up. And when it filled up, he put it on his shoulders, took it in his hand, put it on his shoulder, and he was going. As he was going now, and now the army and Umar ibn Sa'd knew that this would embolden Hussein and the army of Hussein and the camp of Hussein. Umar ibn Sa'd said, do not let this water get back to Hussein's tent. And now there are 500 soldiers who were guarding the river. By the time Abbas came out, there were 4,000 soldiers who were guarding the river. And then as soon as Abbas started going back, they knew they cannot let him go. And they started pouncing on him from different sides. Abbas would cut them up. He would cut them up. But then someone came from behind with a sword, struck his right hand. He struck his right hand, and the right hand fell to the ground. But Abbas was undeterred. He didn't even notice the hand being cut. He just said to them, "In qata'tumu yamini, falahumi yamdini." Oh, if you cut my right hand, I don't care about my right hand. I will not do what my religion has told me to do. Abbas goes forward. Now he has the flag between his leg and the horse and the water bag on the other hand. But then as soon a point came when now his left hand was also cut, and they cut his left hand with a strike. And when his left hand fell to the ground, Abbas put the water bag immediately in his mouth. He put it in his mouth so that he can safeguard it. Oh, now my hands are gone. My hands are no more. I don't have a right hand, nor do I have a left hand, but I do have the water. I do have the water. The water is more important. The children are more important. Hussein is more important. Let me take this to Hussein. Abbas doesn't lose hope. He carries forward. He goes forward. And as he moves forward, and they see that Abbas is now armless, he doesn't have arms. Now seeing that they're immune from Abbas's attack, now a shout is raised in the ground, in the battlefield, by the commanders who say, Hamalu, it is said in the books, Hamalu alayhi bil ajma'in. Everyone, they all pounced on him together. All of them from every side, they pounced on him together. Firqatum min as-sahab, firqatum bis-saham.
wo fir khatum bil hajar. Some of them, they attacked him with arrows. They started shooting it at them. And those who didn't have arrows, they had rocks. They were throwing rocks at him. So many arrows came from so many sides. An arrow lodged into his chest. An arrow lodged into the eye. An arrow lodged into the water bag. When the water bag was pierced by an arrow and the water poured out, now Abbas stopped. He could not move forward. Now his life, his blood, and the water all drained away. They drained away. Now Abbas is thinking, shall I move forward? Shall I go backwards? How can I go forward? I have no water. How can I go backwards? I have no arms. You know, let me just tell you something. Let me tell you a story so that you can give your condolences to Abbas. You know, someone some time ago read in a majlis that this arrow that got stuck in the eyes of Abbas. An arrow was stuck in the eyes of Abbas. So one alim who was in the majlis, he heard that. And he came to the person who recited the majlis and he said, you know, I read some books and I don't see this riwayat you read that Abbas says, I was pierced by an arrow. Why are you reading this? It's not authentic. It's not reliable. Don't do this. The same alim, this is the story is from the alim who criticizes. He goes back and that same night he has a dream. The same night he has a dream and he sees Abbas in his dream. Abbas comes to him and says, you have done injustice to me. He says, why, Mawla? What is wrong? Why did I say? He says, because you said there was no arrow in my eye. He says, there was no arrow in my eye. He says, but I didn't read it. Abbas says, I'm here to tell you, yes, there was indeed an arrow in my eye. You know, there was an arrow in my eye. When I was on top of the horse, there was an arrow in my eye. And you know what? Let me tell you my musibah, let me tell you the tragedy of the moment. I knew the arrow was in the eye. It was bothering me. It was bothering me. And I wanted to take it out. But every time I tried, I noticed I didn't have any arms. I didn't have arms to hold. Ashrakum Allah, Ashrakum Allah. May Allah bless you all, really. Abbas is alone in the battlefield, surrounded by demons who want to cut him up. They see him with no arms, so they start hitting him from all sides. And you know what? As Abbas was sitting on the horse, someone came with an iron mace and smashed that into his head. You know what an iron mace is? It's not like a sword that cuts through you. It is a solid ball of steel. And when they struck Abbas on the head, the force of the blow was such that Abbas was thrown off the horse, face front, and he landed on his face. He landed on his face. Hussein, when he went down, the only thing you say is, Ya Akha, Ya Akha, oh my brother, my brother. When Hussein came running, finding Abbas. Abbas fell down, but Hussein's back was broken. Hussein said, Alan in Qatara Dahari, my back has been broken now. He comes to Abbas, and puts the head of Abbas on his lap. lap. Abbas, his fat now on the lap, notices that and pushes himself out of the lap of Hussein onto the ground. Hussein says, Abbas, what happened? Why are you? Why don't you want to be in my lap? He says, Mawla, what will happen to you after me is worse than what has happened to me. It is worse than what has happened to me. So let me not take the pleasure of having a pillow. This sand will be my pillow like your head. Abbas, my friends, bid farewell to Abbas as he is going now. Abbas says there to my Mawla, two things I want to tell you. Please, Mawla, this is my wasiha to you. My wasiha to you. He says, don't take me back to the camp. Don't take me back to the camp. He says, because the children, they have hopes in their uncle. And I am too embarrassed to go in front of them. I am too ashamed to go in front of them. Hussein said, yes, I accept that. I will not take you back. What is your other wish? He said, Mawla, Mawla, I know that I will see your mother right after I die. I will see your mother after I die. But before I go, I want to see your face. Because when I came into this world, I saw your face. I want to see your face. So remove the blood from my eyes. Hussein, remove the blood from the eyes of Abbas. Abbas opened and saw Hussein.
ما تنسى يا حسين.